It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferris. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, we look at the Supreme Court ruling that knocks down a Louisiana law on abortion clinics in the state. First, the Trump administration asked the U.S. Supreme Court late last week to strike down the Affordable Care Act, also known as Obamacare, in its entirety. In the court filing, administration officials said that because Congress has done away with the law's individual mandate, the rest of it should be tossed out, too. The latest legal action is part of the White House effort to support a lawsuit led by Texas and 17 other states seeking to overturn the 10-year-old ACA. While arguments in the case aren't expected for months, the impact of a decision to strike down the law would be far-reaching, especially as Americans deal with the health impacts of and financial fallout of the COVID-19 pandemic. Philip Bracco is an assistant professor of political science at Marquette University. He's author of the book Obamacare Wars, Federalism, State Politics, and the Affordable Care Act. Phil, welcome back to Central Time.
Always good to be here, Rob.
Well, let's talk a little bit about what's going on in the Supreme Court here. The basic idea that because the tax penalty for not having insurance isn't part of the ACA anymore, that got removed by Congress, the rest of it should be struck down because of past Supreme Court rulings. Can you talk a little more about the court side of this?
Yeah, so this is, I think it's important to set the context here because this is a very unusual move for the executive branch when the constitutionality of duly passed laws comes up. It's usually the case that the executive branch defends those laws. And what we're seeing here is the executive branch actually agreeing with these 17 states and a few individuals that the Affordable Care Act is unconstitutional and should be struck down in its entirety. The case itself builds on sort of two legs of challenges to the ACA that have come over the years. So on the one hand, you might recall that in 2012, the Supreme Court upheld the Affordable Care Act individual mandate, that provision of the law that requires you to carry insurance coverage. But it did so because it said the individual mandate was a tax. And so what the administration is arguing is that in 2017, the Republicans in Congress passed a piece of legislation called the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act. And what that piece of legislation did was it zeroed out the penalty in the individual mandate. And so what the administration is claiming is that now, because that penalty is zeroed out, that provision of the law is now no longer a tax. Now, I think it's important to note that that's kind of an odd legal argument because it assumes that when Republicans passed that piece of legislation, zeroing out the penalty, that they knew, in some sense, that the provision was unconstitutional. But it's very, very hard to find evidence that they knew that. The second piece of the case, and I think the far more impactful one for most people, because, of course, the individual mandate has already been effectively nullified by Congress by zeroing out the penalty, so most people aren't experiencing that kind of penalty now. The other piece of the case is that the administration and the 17 states are saying that if the individual mandate is unconstitutional, that the rest of the ACA has to fall. And the really challenging legal aspect of this is that, back in 2015, there was a case called King versus Burwell. One of the sort of features of the case was that the court in its decision sort of made the argument that the individual mandate was sort of tied in some way to the rest of the law. But what Congress did when it zeroed out the penalty in 2017 was it actually chose not to repeal the rest of the law. And in fact, there were a number of other votes in Congress that you can look at in which it was hard for Republicans to even get a bare majority in the Senate for repealing little sections of the law. And so, again, I think one of the tricky legal things here is that the administration is saying that what Congress intended to do in 2017 when it zeroed out the penalty was get rid of the law in its entirety. And that's something that I think legal commentators really from across the political spectrum have observed is one of the oddest features in this case. And when the Supreme Court makes its decision, it will ultimately, that kind of ruling will have impacts that go far beyond the case of the ACA itself. And so the real question that you imagine the court is going to be wrestling with here is, Should we read into the legislative process something that the legislative process doesn't really offer us? And so I think it might be the case that we don't see the sort of standard sort of ideological split that we see, the 5-4 kind of split on this case, because the implications of that for a lot of duly passed laws are quite far-reaching.
Talking to Philip Rocco from Marquette University, looking at the Trump administration's filing asking the U.S. Supreme Court to completely rule the Affordable Care Act as unconstitutional, ending the whole thing. Philip, that's the legal side of things we've gotten into. Let's talk about the impact. Now, this arguments haven't been heard yet, won't be heard for months, it looks like. But supposing the Supreme Court agreed with the Trump administration and the Texas-led effort here, a lot of people think of the Affordable Care Act as, you know, the marketplace. That's one of the things that would go away. Can you talk about what else would go away if the Supreme Court ruled that way?
Well, when I usually come on Central Time, this is sort of deja vu. We talk about the the millions of people, 27 million people who would lose coverage, or I think it's like 24 million people, excuse me, who would lose coverage, who have already gained it under the ACA. That's people who have gained it from Medicaid, people who have gained it from the individual marketplace as well. But there's a twist now. And the twist is that in addition to those people who have already gained coverage through the ACA, you also have to think about that we're now living through a time where 27 million people have lost jobs by the sort of latest estimates from the Kaiser Family Foundation. Of those, 26.8 are newly uninsured. And of those 26.8, 22.78 are eligible for subsidized coverage through the ACA, either through the individual marketplace or through Medicaid. And so the implications of this decision will reach not only the people who have already received coverage under the Affordable Care Act, but the people for whom the employer-sponsored insurance that they've been able to receive is because of layoffs, something that is no longer available to them. So what we have now is a really lower bound on the size and scale of the population that's increased. And the other thing that I'll say about that is that beyond, so we think about this, when we talk about the ACA or Obamacare, we think mainly about people who are newly insured, but the law does so much more than that. If you think about what we really rely on in the midst of a pandemic to deal with the public health impacts of the pandemic, you would think about things like rural hospitals and community health centers in urban areas. Those are two sets of institutions that the ACA, either through grants in the case of community health centers, or in the case of rural hospitals through Medicaid, has really, the law has really helped to sustain revenue for those sorts of organizations. And so the real question you have to ask yourself is, what might happen if the ACA is repealed in its entirety? What would the implications be for those aspects of the public health infrastructure? And I think what we can say is that they would be weakened substantially in terms of just their ability to keep the lights on.
There's also the pre-existing condition side of the Affordable Care Act, rules against denying coverage or charging considerably more for coverage, I believe, for people with pre-existing conditions. That, as I understand, would go away if the ACA were repealed?
Yes. I mean, you have to think about this. It's hard to, once laws pass, they sort of become like the air we breathe, right? It's hard to remember what the world was like before they passed. And, you know, so this thing we've sort of taken for granted, the idea that, for example, adult children up to the age of 26 can be on their parents' insurance. That will go away. The individual protection for people with pre-existing conditions, barring insurers from denying them care, that will go away as well. So this is really a reset to a status quo that I think by this point, few people can even remember. So it is what I'm discussing here is really only the tip of the iceberg.
We're talking to Philip Rocco right now, assistant professor of political science at Marquette University, author of the book Obamacare Wars, looking at the White House request that the U.S. Supreme Court strike down the Affordable Care Act. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you rely on getting insurance through the Affordable Care Act? Has a furlough or job loss lately meant that the ACA is now your way of being insured? What's been good or bad about the experience? Do you think that the Obamacare law, that the Affordable Care Act, should be overturned? What would you like to see replace it? If so, call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We heard from Angelo on Facebook who said, I rely on the ACA currently. I had great insurance through my employer, but I'm currently furloughed. I can't afford COBRA. Without ACA, I would be uninsured. And Becky also wrote that she lost her job due to COVID-19 and is relying on Obamacare right now. Share your thoughts, 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our talk now with Phil Rocco from Marquette University, author of the book Obamacare Wars. We're looking at the latest legal challenge to the Affordable Care Act. You can join in. 800-642-1234 is the number. What do you think of the Trump administration request for the Supreme Court to strike down the Affordable Care Act? Have you relied on the ACA now or in the past for your health coverage? Are you worried about what happens if it goes away? If you want to see it done away with, tell us what you want to see replace it. Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Let's bring on a caller now. Mary Kay is with us in Kenosha. Mary Kay, hello.
Hello. I believe in competition, and I'm happy they're overturning Obamacare. But in place of it, we need the competition right now. So state Badger Care, everybody would pay into it according to their income. If they made hardly any income, they'd have to hardly pay anything. Okay, and then they have to make a law, make it into law that pre-existing conditions would be covered.
Mary Kay, thanks a lot for the call. And again, it's not being overturned yet. It's a Supreme Court challenge. They haven't heard arguments on that yet. But thanks for calling in, Mary Kay. So Mary Kay saying we need more competition into the system, Phil, but seeing a role for Badger Care and wanting to keep those pre-existing conditions coverage requirements in place.
Yeah, I think Mary Kay's positions are, in fact, the idea of wanting to have care available for as many people as possible, and as well to really be able to preserve some of the protections that people with pre-existing conditions have enjoyed under the ACA are actually, quite popular. And it's when you look at approval of the ACA, or sometimes referred to as Obamacare overall, it splits along partisan lines when you talk about it as the entire law. So, something like 70% of Republicans still disapprove, and similar percentage or northward of that of Democrats approve of the ACA. So there's some partisan division. But when you look at the actual material provisions, what the law really does, there's sort of massive public approval really across both parties for making it so that people don't have to go into bankruptcy when they incur health care costs, or protecting people who don't have the income to afford health care. Those basic ideas enjoy wide bipartisan support. And so this is actually, I think, one of the interesting aspects about what the Trump administration is doing politically, which is, so when it comes to the sort of material consequences of repealing the ACA, there's not a lot of support for that. Once you look at the actual prospect of the ACA being repealed, public opinion sort of responds in a pretty negative way. What the Trump administration, I think, is banking on here, or what they're hoping for, is that this case isn't going to be heard by the Supreme Court until well into election season. It will not be decided until 2021 after the election. And so I think what they're hoping for here is that the Republican base is going to respond to this move in a sort of symbolic way, thinking about this as, we elected Donald Trump to get rid of Obamacare, to sort of repudiate the political legacy of Barack Obama, and not necessarily to get rid of, all of the sort of material consequences of the law, but to sort of engage in that kind of symbolic activity. That, I think, is the hope for the election. But we are in a sort of different political moment than we were in 2016. When you look at 2016,
a sort of an election happening after two decades of a Democratic president, sort of increasing division sort of around some of the issues that Donald Trump brings up during that campaign. But now Trump is the incumbent. You're in the midst of a pandemic. Republicans have tried and failed to repeal the ACA several times. And it might be the case that the kind of bump that Trump might enjoy from the base for sort of pressing on with his legal maneuver against the ACA might not be matched with the same sort of response as they might be expecting. It might actually unleash a backlash as well from Democrats and independents who sort of overwhelmingly support the ACA.
Let's go back to our callers now at 800-642-1234. Jennifer is with us in Milwaukee. Jennifer, hi.
Hi.
So, what do you want to bring up, Jennifer?
I've been on the Affordable Care Act since the beginning. And for me, it's been a lifesaver because I have a pre-existing condition. And so without it, I wouldn't have insurance. But also, I get assistance to help pay for my deductible as well as my premium. But without that assistance, the way it is now, the deductibles have gone so high that most people can't afford it.
Jennifer,
so they
thanks.
Do need to make some changes.
Jennifer, thanks a lot for the call. And Phil, that is a concern. Some people clearly, like Jennifer, have benefited, but there are people, especially at certain economic ranges, who really haven't and would have a hard time paying for the marketplace if they can't get insurance elsewhere.
Oh, absolutely. And I think if you think about what the ACA really was that it was an attempt to plug some of the most egregious holes that had been left in the American approach to health insurance. But it didn't change some of the underlying dynamics that make this system that we have, this sort of very fragmented system, kind of unsustainable, which is it didn't really harness the growth in prices, which push up the cost for insurers and individuals. It also didn't really deal with the fact that it's not just uninsurance, the fact that people lack insurance. It's the insurance coverage that people have, including insurance through the ACA. Still leaves them on the hook for a significant portion, in many cases, of their annual income. And so this is the concept of underinsurance, right? You have an insurance product, you carry an insurance product, but it really doesn't pay the bulk of the costs you incur when you go to the doctor, when you go to the pharmacist's counter. And so, you know, I think one of the interesting things is that when you hear the Trump administration questioned about, you know, what exactly do they want to do after they repeal the Affordable Care Act? What is their replacement? They sort of nod to the fact that most people still experience these sorts of problems, even with the ACA, but, you know, really as the result of this, the fundamental logic of the American health insurance non-system, as it were. But what exactly they would do to reach those goals is unclear. And if this sort of the playbook that Republicans put out for the last few times they attempted to repeal and replace the ACA would hold or would obtain, it isn't clear that those dynamics would be reversed at all. In fact, if you look at the analyses that came out after the first series of attempts to repeal and replace the ACA in 2017, it would seem that it would leave more people uninsured and underinsured, more people effectively paying more and more of their income for insurance, you know, and really leaving people without the kind of support that, again, has sort of broad public approval.
I want to bring on one more caller before we run out of time. Jeff is with us near La Crosse. Jeff, hello.
Hi. Say, the gentleman who was speaking pretty much covered my two points. I was just going to say that, you know, I'm a 60-year-old truck driver, and I take cholesterol-lowering medication. And the preventative aspects of the Affordable Care Act make my company health insurance a great insurance. I don't, you know, it encourages me to come in and get blood work regularly at no cost. I have zero copays for my statins, for my cholesterol-lowering medications, which I might not be taking if I had to pay a lot of money out of pocket. The point made that I was going to make as well is that the Republicans and Mr. Trump, he says that we're going to get rid of the Affordable Care Act and we're going to have great health care. But what does that mean? We're going to have great health care once we get rid of it. They should really propose something if they want to get rid of the Affordable Care Act.
Jeff, thanks a lot for the call. Just in our last minute, Phil, that's a point, the preventive care aspect of the Affordable Care Act.
Right. I think that the inclusion of the Affordable Care Act really began to treat essential health benefits to treat preventative care as an essential health benefit, something that insurers had to cover. And again, I think the point that Jeff makes really well is that once people start thinking about this related to the material sort of consequences of repealing the ACA, the political calculus really does change. I think what the Trump administration is sort of hoping for, if I could trace out their ideal, is they want Trump to win the 2016 election and have the Supreme Court repeal the ACA, setting up some kind of political opportunity structure where Trump can sort of put his seal on the space of health insurance. But it's not really clear that political logic squares with the way that voters are thinking about this. Health is really at the top of the agenda in a number of key races. It's really still squarely at the top in voters' minds. It's not clear that sort of the reality and how voters think about it is how the Trump administration has projected.
Phil, thanks a lot for joining us again today.
Always good to be with you, Rob.
That's Philip Rocco, assistant professor of political science at Marquette University and author of the book Obamacare Wars, Federalism, State Politics, and the Affordable Care Act. He talked with us about the Trump administration's request that the U.S. Supreme Court strike down the ACA in its entirety. Coming up after the news, another look at the U.S. Supreme Court. The court blocked a more restrictive abortion law in a ruling this morning. We'll check out the case and what it means for state laws around the country. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, the latest Marquette Law School survey asked Wisconsinites how they're feeling about their financial well-being. Pollster Charles Franklin joins the show to share some of their answers. First, the U.S. Supreme Court decided to invalidate a Louisiana law that the majority said limited women's access to abortions in the state to an unconstitutional degree. The 5-4 vote included Chief Justice John Roberts on the majority side. Kimmy King is a distinguished teaching professor in the Department of Political Science at the University of North Texas. Kimmy, welcome back to the show.
Good to be back.
Well, remind us, Kimmy, about this Louisiana law that made its way up to the U.S. Supreme Court.
So the June Medical Services versus Rousseau decision involved a Louisiana law that was strikingly similar to a Texas law that had been taken up in 2016. And in that decision, the Supreme Court had struck down this requirement that abortion doctors have admitting privileges in hospitals near where the clinic and the abortion is performed. If you're pro-life, the logic is that the doctor needs to have admitting privileges in case something goes wrong. If you're pro-choice, you point out the fact that that is rarely, if ever, used because that's just simply not the nature of the abortion procedure, and it's the question of whether or not there is some additional benefit by having this law in place or whether it creates a burden on the woman who's seeking reproductive access. And that's what the court was considering, was a Louisiana law that took up that issue.
Looking at the result, I said 5-4. I've seen some people say it's actually sort of 4-4-1, and the one broke the tie in a particular way. Let's look at first each of the fours here. The liberal group, if we can call it that, in the U.S. Supreme Court, what was their argument? Was it basically what you just said, that benefit versus burden?
Yeah, that's correct. And you see the dissent saying they've come up with a new test. Right. And so the liberals took this position that this is unnecessary. It drops the accessibility down to literally one abortion provider in the state of Louisiana would have had the credentials necessary. And it's that kind of limited access that the liberals pointed out created an undue burden.
And then the four who were against it, the dissent, what was their case for why they wanted to uphold this Louisiana law?
So the issue is that the state legislature should be able to make these kinds of determinations. If they also point out that there isn't this causal connection, that just because requiring doctors have admission privileges doesn't mean that women are going to have less access because of the admission privileges. And so they just take issue with the logic of what denying the admission privileges will do. And of course, then everybody's pinning on Justice Roberts, who was the critical swing voter here today. And I would be remiss if I didn't point out that in the 2016 opinion, he was in the dissent. He had voted with the dissent to say that he thought that the Texas law was okay as it stood. Today's opinion points out that, you know, really all he's saying is he believes in stare decisis, or this idea of letting prior case law and decision making stand rather than to keep reversing itself all the time. And that's why Roberts joined the liberal bloc.
Right. So if I'm understanding this correctly, he didn't really enter into this benefit versus undue burden argument. He said this is basically the same case we decided in 2016, even though I was on the other side. There's not enough different in front of the court here to change and reverse that precedent. Do I have that right?
That's absolutely correct. And it's consistent with Roberts being a wait just a minute here. Everybody stay calm, which has been his approach in a number of different cases. In many instances, what I think you're going to see is Justice Roberts balancing out this concern over wild shifts on the court. And it's his way of saying, not so quickly. Let's think this through very carefully. This is an issue that's already been decided. It's completely consistent with a more conservative ideology to not be constantly changing your mind about what the law is in order to produce some kind of social change that you want to see happen.
We're talking to Kimmy King, distinguished teaching professor in the Department of Political Science at the University of North Texas, looking at this morning's U.S. Supreme Court decision. It overturned new abortion restrictions in effect from Louisiana. We're talking about what it means for the future. And Kimmy, with what Robert said, what if a completely different abortion restriction came up, not related to admitting privileges? This did not at all commit him to overturn that kind of law. We could see other changes.
Oh, right. Absolutely. And you are going to continue to see the wave of challenges continue to make their way up through the court. I mean, there are no less than 50 different kinds of restrictions that are out there among the states that, you know, can be considered. And what the court does is this case by case analysis, and whether or not it's placing, you know, requirements on what doctors have to do if an aborted, you know, fetus or child, depending on what your view is and how you see this issue, if that fetus or child is born alive, what you have to do, whether or not you can mandate sonograms that women have to watch before they get an abortion, whether or not you can prohibit state facilities and employees from being involved in any way with the abortion process. There's just no limit to the kinds of restrictions that are out there in the states that can continue to move forward.
And as I understand it, Kimmy, a lot of this comes from a case, not Roe versus Wade, which made abortion legal around the country, but a case called Planned Parenthood versus Casey in the early 90s. That's where this whole case law about, you know, how much of a burden, how much of a restriction can you put on women seeking abortion came from. Is that right?
Yeah, that's absolutely correct. So what Roe v. Wade did was it set up this trimester framework. And it said that we break down the pregnancy decision into three, you know, periods of time, first trimester, second, third. It's only after the second trimester that you can begin prohibiting abortions. Planned Parenthood came in and said, wait a minute, that doesn't work. We are able to save babies or fetuses, depending on your view, at early and earlier ages. So what the standard is whether or not the fetus or child is viable. Have they achieved viability? And even if so, you cannot create an undue burden on the woman. And it's this undue burden standard that has consistently been a concern about people that tend to be more pro-choice.
This was seen, this particular ruling was seen as maybe a test, Kimmy, of whether, you know, with President Trump's appointees now on the court, whether it would be more sympathetic to challenges to abortion, to restrictions on abortion. Can we read this case that way?
Well, the way you can most definitely read it is that Roberts is not going to be drawn into this political fray. It doesn't matter whether you are a Democratic legislator attacking Supreme Court justices. He's not going to stand for it. If you think he's going to be somebody that's just a political hack who's going to do whatever his ideology you might otherwise predict he would do, he's not going to have it. Chief Justice John Roberts is his own man, and he's going to make decisions based on the principled findings of the cases before him, and he's not going to be drawn in to any kind of political fray.
Do you see this case potentially, given everything else going on in the country, this particular ruling being an issue in the presidential race this year?
It absolutely will be. And what's going to be interesting to watch is the extent to which President Trump uses this case as support for why he needs to keep putting, you know, better, more conservative judges and justices on the bench. But it will also be curious whether or not he attacks the courts. Because in recent days, they've also given President Trump some wins. Even just today, they said that it violated the president's authority to set in place the Consumer Protection Bureau the way we have it set up. And so it found that that violated the separation of powers and interfered with the president's authority. So the president has to tread carefully here in his attacks on the Supreme Court. But without a doubt, he will use this abortion decision as a reason for why we need to keep bringing conservative abortion cases up through the federal courts and his over 200 federal judges that he's now appointed to keep challenging abortion access.
Kimmy, thanks again for joining us today.
You betcha. Love public radio.
That's Kimmy King, Distinguished Professor of Political Science at the University of North Texas. We talked to her today about the Supreme Court ruling today that strikes down a Louisiana law regulating abortion clinics. Coming up, the pandemic economy has affected a lot of people's financial security. We'll find out how Wisconsinites are faring with the results of a new survey. That's up next here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, public health officials in Wisconsin and around the country have received public threats about their efforts to control the coronavirus. We'll find out what happens if experienced health officials quit as a result. First, the global coronavirus pandemic has affected people's health and well-being in many different ways, including their ability to work and support themselves and their families. While a complete picture is still months or even years off, there's some info available about the impact of the first few months of the pandemic economy on Wisconsin residents. And just like the health impact of COVID-19, the economic impact is hitting some harder than others. Charles Franklin is professor of law and public policy at Marquette University and director of the Marquette Law School poll. Charles, good to have you back with us.
It's good to be here, Rob. Thanks.
Well, what did you do that you always do when it comes to asking people about their well-being? And what did you add in this unique economic situation in the latest survey?
Absolutely. Also, let me start by crediting my colleague, Lubar fellow John Johnson, who wrote this analysis up, and it's on our website. John had a prior obligation tonight, so I'm just pinch-hitting for him.
Well, we'll settle for you, I guess.
Well, it's a step down, I got to tell you. John's really excellent, and people should follow his work. Now, here's what we found. First of all, unemployment, to no surprise, has really surged. The official government statistics, 14% unemployed in April, 12 in May here in the state. We haven't got the June numbers yet. But in our poll, the Marquette Law School poll, we found in June 13% had lost a job and 23% had had a family member lose their job. In addition, 23% had had work hours reduced. So in all, 27% had either lost a job themselves or had their own work hours cut, and then it was more for other family members. So that's the sort of impact. But what we focused on is, how are you getting along financially yourself? Back in January, 63% said they were living comfortably, 28% said they were just getting by, and 8% said they were struggling. But the puzzle here that John addressed in the analysis is, in June, it was still 61% comfortable, 31% just getting by, and actually only 6% struggling. So what happened here? Why isn't there any change?
Yeah.
And the answer is what you opened with, the substantial inequality of how people are experiencing the economic impact depending on their circumstances. And that's the analysis we get into.
Yeah. So how did this break down unevenly in the state, this economic hit from the coronavirus?
So first of all, by racial category, there are big differences. Black Wisconsinites lost their jobs at about twice the rate that white Wisconsinites did. As a result, we see that in this numbers of black respondents. In January and February, before the epidemic, only 10% said they were struggling. That more than doubled to 22% in the latest surveys. On the Hispanic and Latino side, the bigger fall is on the comfortable end. 66% were living comfortably before the epidemic. That has fallen to 47% among Hispanic and Latino respondents. That's the racial gap, and we've seen that in each of the months since the epidemic hit, that it falls disproportionately on people of color. But we also saw big differences depending on whether you had, in fact, lost a job or not.
And let's talk about income breakdown. Now, a lot of the jobs that took hits here were jobs you do in person, a lot of them service, retail, restaurant. Often not the best paying jobs. Is it possible that these people might have said even before they lost their jobs, they were financially struggling?
It certainly depends on what your income level is how likely you are to say that you are comfortable. We'll use that category here for comparison. But what you see is across the board, those who did not lose a job are actually a bit more comfortable now, whereas those who have lost a job are substantially less comfortable. For those in the less than $40,000 income bracket, 37% were comfortable before the epidemic hit. But after the epidemic, of those with no job loss, 47% are comfortable. That falls off to just 24% comfortable for those who've lost a job. And at the opposite end of the scale, those making over $75,000 a year, 80% were comfortable before the epidemic. Those without a job loss, that number goes up to 90% comfortable now, and it falls off to 74% for those who've had a job loss in their home.
And if I read your colleague's analysis right, there could be a subjective sense of relief. I am feeling more satisfied position because I'm one of the lucky ones who didn't lose a job. Is that part of the story, maybe?
That's certainly right. We think there are three plausible stories here, one of which is just simply the relief of looking around and seeing other people who are suffering in economically and saying, wow, I've dodged that bullet. Another is that you may actually be better off if you're not paying to commute, you're not paying gas, you're not doing mileage or maintenance on your car. You may not be eating out as much and not spending as much money on takeout, for example. And finally, it may also be that people who are already in more precarious situations are also the people most likely to suffer a job loss. And so that's another possible contribution. I think all three of these play some role in how we've felt the economic impact, but the gap between those losing jobs and those not is quite large, and it varies by income, but the relative status is always the same. Those losing the jobs are the hardest hit.
Charles Franklin is with us from the Marquette University Law School poll, looking at what Wisconsinites had to say in the most recent survey about their sense of economic well-being, their ability to live comfortably. Charles, in a way, it feels like we've been in this forever. In other ways, we're still in early days. What are you watching for when it comes to people's economic well-being and how they feel about it in future polls?
Yeah, I think the first thing is, have we plateaued on job losses, or are we still adding to those losses? With the reopening of the state economy, those jobs might be coming back or the losses lower. On the other hand, we are seeing an increase in COVID cases right now, which raises real doubts about what the next 2 or 3 months look like. I think it's uncertain which direction we go, but looking for signs of any sustainable economic improvement is a big thing. Still, remember, we've gone from 3, almost 4% unemployment to 12, 13, 14% unemployment. This is a dramatic change that likely takes a good while to make up.
Do you see comparisons or precedents, say, from the Great Recession that started in 2008 when it came to how it affected people in the state?
Yeah, I think the biggest thing about the Great Recession was it built over a number of months. You know, we saw the front end of that as early as 2007 and early 2008, and then it built through 08 and 09, and then we slowly added jobs back after that. Here, it was like flipping a light switch. When March came and we shut down the economy, shut down going out, we saw this amazingly sharp rise in unemployment here in the state and nationally. Now, with the reopening efforts, the question is, how rapidly can we recover? It seems unlikely that it bounces back in the same way the light switch was flipped off. It can't be switched back on. And we have this continuing question of, you know, is how well controlled is the epidemic, and how much do we risk by seeing rapidly rising cases like we're seeing in Arizona, Texas, and Florida right now?
We asked our listeners on the Ideas Network Facebook page a similar question to what you had asked your survey respondents. Brandy on Facebook writes, we're the same when it comes to their economic well-being, but she says, I work for an essential business, and my husband now works from home. Not everyone has that luxury. And that's another weird aspect of this here, Charles. It's almost random. Like, we couldn't have predicted before this thing that one group of people was going to abruptly lose jobs and another were going to keep it, and not because they planned really well in advance.
I think that's right, and it cuts two ways. A lot of people in essential businesses are people in blue-collar jobs working in grocery stores, for example, or gas stations. Others who have done well are the white-collar workers that can work from home with relatively little disruption. But we do see that the social and economic inequality that existed before the pandemic is also showing itself here in terms of the job losses being more concentrated in the lower income and also in the racial minority segment of the population. Those at the higher end have not all avoided losses, but are less likely to have been hit with losses. And again, professionals who are able to work from home may have had their routines disrupted, but not their livelihoods as much.
We'll leave it there for now. Charles, thanks a lot for sharing this with us today.
Thank you, Rob.
We've been talking to Charles Franklin. He's a professor of law and public policy at Marquette University and director there of the Marquette Law School poll. He joined us to share their findings on how the pandemic economy is affecting Wisconsinites. They asked people about that in their latest survey, in addition to the usual political questions and more. And there's still time for you to let us know how you are doing. We have a question up over at the Ideas Network Facebook page. Are things going, you know, the routine might be different, but are things going well enough for you? You were able to make the adjustment to no job losses. Has your job been lost completely, temporarily, partially with cutback hours? How is that affecting your family's financial situation? Share your story, share your experiences. You can do that over on the Ideas Network Facebook page. There are a lot of things the country is divided over, like the political disagreements that we talk about from time to time on this show. But I just found out about a fundamental disagreement, about a basic principle of our existence, where the answer is different depending on which state you live in. The question up for debate, how long is a foot? Not the body part, the unit of measurement. The easy answer, 12 inches, right? We can all agree on that. Except, a foot gets measured differently depending on where you are. As reported in Scientific American, there are two standards for how long a foot is, especially when it comes to land surveying. There's the international foot and the U.S. survey foot. Wisconsin officially uses the U.S. survey version, same with most states, but five states, including our neighbors in Michigan, use the international foot. A few states have no official view on the issue. What's the difference? Not much. The ratio of one to the other is 0.999998. So really close to one, really close to the same thing. If you're building a house or surveying property for your township, no problem. But if you're creating GPS coordinates for interstate mapping purposes, then that tiny difference starts to add up. But there's hopeful news. America's surveyors have agreed to come together and adopt the international foot as the common standard in 2023. Turns out at least some of them would rather have switched to the metric system, but that's a fight for another day. Give them a foot, they'll take a meter. This is Central Time.